ebook publishers and marketing services company, Just Imagine Inc. presents Get Behind Me, Now Stay There, a fun-filled, informative podcast available on iTunes and right here locally on KSKQ Ashland, Oregon, art and entertainment news and views. Today, we talk to Benjamin Wilkins about the film he's producing in Peru, Tony McCauley tells us about A Dream Before Dying, and in Chuck Palahniuk's new book, A Marijuana Overdose Doesn't End the Story, all coming up right after this news. Hello, and thank you for joining us for a show filled with the information you want to know. I'm Cyrus Emerson.
And I'm Lucia Sherman. Here's a look at our top stories in the art and entertainment world. Art can be a potent weapon in the service of a cause. Artists with a political consciousness can dedicate their work to causes they believe in. Poster art is one of the most powerful means of communication, and the examples in the Stephen Lewis's exhibit speak eloquently of the battle for fair wages, decent conditions, and social justice. In the Ashland Public Library's downstairs gallery from September 2nd to September 29th, posters from his collection will be on display at the library. Lewis is a longtime activist in the labor movement and is currently the treasurer of his union.
Yeah, I better make sure I got my library card renewed because I'd like to go see that.
Do you even check out books from the library?
I just recently learned how to read, so yes.
Oh.
When I get to the library, it's wild, I'll tell you what.
It's, you know, wild?
Yeah, I just start checking out everything, you know, books, movies, CDs, yeah, women, everything.
Women?
Yeah, and, you know.
That's the Cyrus I know.
And I'm hoping that, you know, this next story, I'll be able to check out the DVD at the library soon.
Well, tell me about it.
Well, an all-star group of the most influential and socially responsible artists in music, film, and television are coming together for a special concert to celebrate the work of President Clinton and his foundation since he completed his second term in the White House 10 years ago. It's called A Decade of Difference and will highlight the Clinton Foundation's efforts to improve global health, strengthen economies worldwide, promote healthier childhoods, and protect the environment. President Clinton has defined the way we think about giving and philanthropy. In addition to his foundation work, he has served as the top United Nations envoy for the Indian Ocean tsunami recovery effort and currently serves as a UN special envoy to Haiti. For more information about the concert, visit clintonfoundation.org.
Cyrus, who's going to be at the concert?
Actually, it's going to be Lady Gaga is going to be one of the people. She's like a huge global superstar right now.
You know, I love Lady Gaga. She has a truly, she has a great heart.
That's true.
And has great music.
Yeah, I hear that a lot about her. But people really seem to, you know, love her. And I guess that's why she's just, you know, she's such an international star. And then Usher is going to be there. And there's also going to be a rare acoustic performance with Edge and Bono from U2. So it should be a lot of fun. And like I said, hopefully it'll be on a DVD one of these days. And you'll go to the library and check it out.
And, you know, they're filming that at one of my most favorite venues, the Hollywood Bowl. One of my favorite bands of all time played at the Hollywood Bowl. Do you have any idea who it was?
The Red Hot Chili Peppers.
No. It was someone a little bit older than that group. The Beatles. I'm still a huge Beatles fan. I love the Beatles. But I have some information for you about them, which a lot of people do not know, and I find it very fascinating.
Well, tell me about it.
I will. A soon-to-be auction Beatles contract for the 1965 California concert reveals that the Fab Four took a firm stand in support of the era's civil rights movement, refusing to play before a segregated audience. The contract, which is signed by the Liverpool Group's manager Brian Epstein, specifies that they did not be required to perform in front of a segregated audience for their August 31, 1965 show at the Cow Palace in Daly City, California. The document will be auctioned on September 20th by Nate D. Sanders in Los Angeles. The Beatles took a public stand in civil rights in 1964 during their first American tour when they refused to perform at a segregated concert at the Gator Bowl in Jacksonville, Florida. City officials relented, allowing the stadium to be integrated, and the band did take the stage for that show. The Cow Palace concert was part of the Beatles' third major tour of the United States. The contract signed on March 24, 1965, guaranteed the band $40,000 against gross box office receipts of more than $77,000. In addition to the desegregation requirement, the agreement called for at least 150 uniformed police officers for protection and a special drumming platform for Ringo. The contract is estimated to sell between $3,000 and $5,000. Well, I never saw a Beatles concert, but I guess the Beatles were visionaries in more than one way, and good for them.
And another visionary band, Pearl Jam. Here's some exciting news about them. Cameron Crowe's documentary, Pearl Jam 20, takes viewers on a 20-year behind-the-scenes journey with a band that has reached the top of the rock and roll pantheon while refusing to embrace the spotlight. It's more than just a rock documentary, Academy Award winner Crowe said of the film, that includes footage like Pearl Jam frontman Eddie Vedder slow dancing with Nirvana's Kurt Cobain beneath a stage while Eric Clapton plays Tears in Heaven. Crowe premiered the documentary at the Toronto International Film Festival, and Pearl Jam also released a 384-page book and a 29-song soundtrack to mark its first two decades. A DVD of the documentary with extra footage will follow. The first two decades, I guess Pearl Jam plans to be around for another two decades.
So. Probably. They're good enough.
Definitely.
Love those guys.
They're great.
Yeah.
Yeah, didn't we just do a story about Eddie Vedder and the West Memphis Three?
Yep.
Wow, that guy really gets around, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. Good for him.
Yeah, well, I'm sure all these exciting videos will be available on Netflix.
I'm sure they will be. But, you know, they're on my bad boy list today.
Why is that?
Well, because here's one drama Netflix CEO Reed Hastings certainly doesn't want to stream. It involves his company's shares tanking 90%, wiping out their entire 2011 gains after revealing that a price increase caused 1 million subscribers to disappear. The drama was all too real for Netflix yesterday as its share fell to $169.25, the steepest drop in 3 years following its first subscriber falloff since 2007. Despite the stock price hit, Netflix defended the 60% price hike it announced in July. Quote, "We know our decision to split our services has upset many of our subscribers, which we don't take lightly, but we believe this split will help us make our services better for subscribers and shareholders for years to come," Netflix said in a statement.
It'll be interesting to see how it works out.
Well, the price hikes, coupled with the news that Starz content will be available after February, has sent many disgruntled customers for the doors.
Michael S. Hart, the inventor of the ebook, has passed away at his home. Hart's first ebook was a version of the Declaration of Independence that he typed into the computer himself. His initial goal was to digitize 10,000 books. Gutenberg now offers access to more than 36,000 titles without registration or fee. Hart campaigned against extensions of U.S. copyright. The majority of the books in Project Gutenberg were published prior to 1920 and therefore in the public domain. And in a refreshingly non-promotional stance, Hart eschewed any form of advertising and firmly stuck with low-tech interfaces. As a 1997 Wired profile of Hart notes, Hart's low-profile outlook sometimes hamstrung the reach of the Gutenberg project because funders tend to be interested in projects that use state-of-the-art technology. Well, it's so sad that he passed away, but he left quite a legacy with the e-books.
Yes, he certainly did. You know, speaking of e-books, look how far that they've come.
Definitely.
Unless you've decided to live a life of solitude during 2010, you've no doubt heard that ebooks and ebook readers, both dedicated e-readers and multi-purpose devices, are hot topics. The sales of e-readers hit 6.6 million in 2010, and ABI Research expects them to reach 30 million by 2012, with 2013 being the year that they really catch fire. Considering that the iPad has sold twice as many units as predicted, it'll be interesting to see if those numbers don't fall by the end of 2011. With so many e-readers, tablets, and smartphones out in the world, the demand for digital content will grow. And within that content, e-books is certain to play a big part. Sales of e-books and e-readers in Europe are well behind that of the U.S. But with recent news that e-books are starting to make an impact in the U.K. and Germany, Europe is certainly catching up, and the next couple of years is going to be very interesting indeed. You know, I love e-books.
Me too. But at first, you know, I really liked old-fashioned books still. You know, I still wanted to flip the pages.
Ooh, and I wanted to grab the book and hold it in my lap and sip a cup of coffee on a rainy day and just kind of...
Exactly. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, you just start to embrace the technology and there's so much more you can do with an e-book compared to just a regular book.
Such as the interactive... option that you have with them?
Definitely.
Yeah. You can pull up pictures via Google. You can, you know, just get lots of information at your fingertips. And you can get visual information. You can get auditory input. It's pretty exciting.
You got that right. That's mind-blowing.
It is mind-blowing.
And, you know, speaking of which, here's a funny little story. Charlie Sheen has teamed up with his father for a parody of Martin Sheen's legendary film, Apocalypse Now. The Comedy Central digital short was filmed to promote Charlie Sheen's roast and marks the first time the father and son have appeared together in a scripted project since Martin Sheen guest starred on 2.5 Men 6 years ago. The spoof was originally going to be just Charlie and the girls in the jacuzzi, and it needed a location. So Sheen suggested shooting in his own backyard. Then Apocalypse Now director Francis Ford Coppola's son, Roman Coppola, came on board as a technical advisor to try and match the opening shot as closely as possible with the original film. If that pairing wasn't surreal enough, on the morning of the shoot, Sheen dropped a bombshell. "We're going to need some lines for my father." "We never imagined that would happen," said the VP of production. Well, I guess they could include that video clip in an ebook as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I loved Apocalypse Now. It was sometimes hard to watch, but what a great film.
Definitely. And I don't know if you've seen there's a director's cut, which is a little bit longer and has some, you know, just interesting footage, great footage. It just makes the story longer, but it was a cut out of the original film.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really good. Good chance. Yeah, check it out at the library.
Well, speaking of hard to watch, it's that time of year again when the local vacant storefront is taken over by the Halloween costume and mask store. But this is also the time of year when Spirit Halloween is buried with job applications as the nation's spooky economy leads over 100,000 applicants to vie for the 20 to 40 jobs at each location, according to reports. Some 1,500 people will be hired in the Bay Area to work Spirit Halloween 45 stores, and each of these stores has received over 1,000 applications for their several dozen jobs. Why such high demand for temporary seasonal work? Well, it's a great way to get a job and get job experience, Amber Young, manager of the Alameda location, said. As long as you're enthusiastic, love Halloween, which I do, and are very friendly, I'll hire people even if it's a first job. The jobs also have a high turnover. Some workers stay for just a few weeks and then move on, according to the newspaper, meaning the spirit stores often hire new applicants throughout October. What do the jobs pay? The reports don't say, nor does the store's online-only application process. You know, Halloween is one of my favorite holidays. I've loved it ever since I was a wee one. Yeah. I love it. It's fun. And to this day, I will never miss dressing up for Halloween or playing tricks on friends or
going trick-or-treating, yeah. Going around the neighborhood and knocking on doors.
Do you
to get
really
candy.
Do that at this age?
No,
Cyrus.
Not anymore. I used to, though. I mean, I loved that about Halloween when I was growing up.
I did.
Big bags of candy and, you know, it's a great holiday.
Yeah,
it's
it is.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. And that's your art and entertainment news. Keep listening for Blackstone's special feature.
Benjamin Wilkins' next journey takes him to the Peruvian film set of La Navaja de Don Juan. The English translation, The Knife of Don Juan. Before he left, he caught up with the president of Just Imagine Inc., Charlie Stanton.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Get Behind Me Now, Stay There. Today, we talk with film producer Benjamin Wilkins. Hey, Ben, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
You're going to be going down to Lima, Peru, which I... memory serves me correct, would be winter when you go there?
It will be fall. Oh, okay. Hopefully not too cold, since we have to shoot 4 days in a swimming pool.
Okay, so you guys are going down there to shoot on your movie The Knife of Don Juan, which is the English translation. Maybe you can give us the Spanish translation.
Sure. It's La Navaja de Don Juan, and that's exactly correct. I'll be leaving on the 22nd, and we'll be down there for about 6 weeks, and we'll shoot the remaining 60 or so minutes of the film.
Well, you know, I've seen the trailer for the movie, and I suggest that everyone go on there and take a look at the trailer. It's just a, you know, it's fantastic. It's maybe you could tell us a little bit about it. It's a, you know, the... I don't know if it's a coming-of-age story, or just because it just seems so... it's like a... like a family growing up story. I could just picture myself, you know, hanging out with one of my brothers when I was growing up, going through some of these scenes.
Yeah, it's definitely a story about brothers. We like to describe it as Y Tu Mama Tambien meets Superbad.
Oh, really?
Oh. Yeah.
Well, you know.
And it's kind of it's a story of two brothers that are very competitive, and they end up at a house party where everything kind of gets out of control, and a bunch of family secrets in the course of everything going crazy get revealed, and the brothers kind of have to come to terms with who they are and the family they actually come from.
And how did you get involved with this production, Ben?
Well, Tom, the director, and I, and Julie, the other producer, all went to University of California's grad film program together. And Tom, about 3 years ago, gave me a script for a short and said, do I want to produce this short film with him? And that script was what this movie eventually became. And I said, I'd be happy to produce this short for you, but I really think you have some great characters here, and I want to know a lot more about them, and I think you should develop it into a feature film. And at the time, I told him that I thought we could shoot the feature film for $50,000 if we shot it in Peru. And he said, really? Because that would be great. And I said, great. And it turned out that we need a lot more money than $2,000, but it got the ball rolling, and it's been rolling for 3 years ever since, and now we finally get to go back and finish it. We had already shot the first 35, 40 minutes of the movie about 2 years ago, and we've been using that first 35 minutes to raise the rest of the money to finish the film.
So this has been quite a long-going project.
It has definitely been an ongoing project.
And when do you think it might be ready for release? Would it be sometime in 2012?
Yeah, the goal and it's every step along the way has taken longer than we anticipated, so don't hold me to this, but the goal is to have it completed in time to attempt to get into Cannes in May. I think Cannes is in May. Don't quote me on that, actually.
Okay.
But I don't know when maybe the deadline's in May, but to have it completed in the middle of next year and out to the film festival before the end of 2012.
Well, you know, I mean, you know, we were watching it just before we came down to the studio today, and the trailers are and it's just fantastic. And why don't you tell everybody where they can see that on a trailer? I'm sure there's several places.
Sure. The website is just the name of the movie. It's a Spanish name, so it's www.lanavajadedonjuan.com, and it's LANAVAJA. DEDONJUAN.com.
Oh, okay.
And if anybody listening is able to actually remember that and write it down, I'll be very impressed because I would never be able to do it.
Well, I'll tell you what we'll do is we will put a link to the trailer and or actually we'll put the trailer itself on the on our website, which is justimagineitinc.com, and that's pretty easy to remember. What kind of films did you watch? I know what you make, but you know, what do you watch?
Ironically, I tend to really like Hollywood movies. And I like nice, you know, easy to swallow popcorn pictures that just provide escapism more than anything else. I think those movies are fun. Every once in a while, you know, you'll get an independent movie that is also fun, and that is the greatest of all. I think your first job, or any movie's first job, has to be to entertain and then to get whatever point you're trying to get across. And I think one of the tragedies of independent film is they're all just way too serious. And so independent comedies and independent, even horror movies. You know, the smaller movies that don't take themselves so seriously are more where I fall into, what I actually enjoy watching.
Are there any actors out there that, you know, here's what I've noticed, Ben, is that we here in Ashland, we have a film festival, independent film festival, and so we see a lot of foreign films and, you know, a lot of independent films here.
Sure.
And you know, I've noticed lately that the trend has been to, you know, a lot of big name actors are doing independent films.
Yep, they are. I think as the stories in the studio system get more and more bland and become remakes of TV shows that were remakes to begin with.
Right.
I think there's a real hunger for actors that actually enjoy acting to get into projects where there's a little more substance to the roles that they get to play, and independent film definitely offers that.
Well, this is what I've noticed. This is from a layman's point of view, is that I've seen that the independent vehicle, the movie per se, always has become like, if you're an actor, say you're Laura Dern, or you know Johnny Depp, or someone like that. So you're obviously, you know, a big marketable star. But you do these films, as you would say, Hollywood films that are, you know, going to make you mega bucks, and everyone's going to go see them just because they're Hollywood movies. But
sure.
But then you're also making these independent films where it's almost like you're saying, you know what, okay, I was a movie star, but now I'm on Broadway because I can really be an actor here. So now, you know, I was doing this, it's a MGM production, but now I'm doing this, you know, this independent film, and it's a low budget. You wouldn't even know I was in this movie. You know, it only way you would know if I was in it is if you saw the movie, where I can really hone my skills.
Yep, that is definitely a newer trend. There's always been, there's what's called a bankable name, that independent films are always struggling to get a bankable name in their cast because that's what distributors look at. So, since oftentimes there's not a lot of money, they have to rely on the strength of the story and the stuff to attract these higher caliber, more famous actors with bankable names to get involved. And it's certainly possible to get people involved. You see, you know, hundreds of independent films that didn't have a whole lot of money to work with really A-list talent because they offer something that the Hollywood fair doesn't. And that's what makes them great.
Yeah, you know what? There was a movie here that came out about 5 years ago. It was called Love is the Drug. And it's an independent film here, and it was, you know, very low budget, but they had Daryl Hannah in it.
Yep.
But she had maybe 10 minutes on film at best.
Yep.
But they drew crowds. I mean, big crowds to go see the movie because they put her name and her likeness up on the marquee.
Yeah, that's exactly how it works. You probably can't afford to have your A-list talent there every day of the shoot because A-list talent has a lot of costs associated with them even beyond what they actually are receiving in pay. You can't treat Hollywood movie stars the way you treat independent film crews, which can be pretty brutal. They tend to not like that very much. So, you get them in for as long as you can afford and as big a role as you can afford. But even if they're only on the screen for 30 seconds, you better believe that their name is up there and they're on the poster because that is how you sell a movie, right now.
Okay, that's fascinating. All right, everybody, I want to let you know that we've been talking with Benjamin Wilkins, the producer of The Knife of Don Juan, or in Spanish, I cannot pronounce it, but maybe Ben can do that for us.
La Navaja de Don Juan.
That is absolutely correct. And I want to encourage everyone to go onto their website and make a donation. Let's make this film happen and bring it out to fruition. Get it out in the movie theaters for hopefully a summer release, 2012. You can go and watch the trailer on justimagineinc.com. And it's been great talking with you, Benjamin, and we'd love to have you on again when the movie comes out.
That sounds great, Charlie. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
To learn more about La Navaja de Don Juan, the English translation, The Knife of Don Juan, visit us on our website at justimagineinc.com, where you can see a trailer of the movie. So are you people!
Tony McCauley's new book encourages an understanding of the second coming of Christ. He spoke about this and more with the president of Just Imagine It, Inc., Charlie Stanton.
Welcome to another episode of Get Behind Me Now, Stay There. Today we talk with author Tony McCauley, whose book is called A Dream Before Dying, and he hails from Atlanta, Georgia. Hi, Tony. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me tonight.
It's great to have you on. And for those of you who don't know Tony's book, he's here to tell you a little bit about it.
What the book is about, it's actually a Christian fiction sci-fi. It's about a young U.S. Army chaplain who is just graduated from college. He's enrolled into Vietnam. He's in the Army. He's going into Vietnam. He's actually searching for his first love, Vanessa. And while he's there, his mission, of course, is to teach the troops about about the second coming of Christ. And things happen to him, and he begins having these dreams while he's there. And his dreams involve him time traveling back to or between 1967 Vietnam and 33 AD Jerusalem. And
wow.
He's actually witnessing the 3-year ministry of Christ. He's reluctant. he's actually reluctant. He doesn't want to be involved in all of this. It's really too much for him to bear. But that's the gist of it. He and all of his squad members actually travel back, not actually travel, but he dreams of traveling, time traveling back to Jerusalem, 33 AD.
And where did you come up with an idea for something like this?
Wow. This is actually a 20-year project for me.
Wow.
Yeah, two decades. Myself, when I resigned from the military, my goal, I enrolled into Georgia State University, and my goal was to actually go into ROTC, go into the seminary, and return to the military as a chaplain. And so I was kind of writing about what I had wanted my life to be.
Right.
Of course, none of it went that way.
It never does.
It never does. And I thank God that he is so patient, because I'm certainly not skeptical all the way. But I spent the time that I spent at Georgia State University joining the church here in Atlanta. I had a pretty close walk with God, and it was a very joyful time in my life, despite how everything went wrong. And it changed me, and it was a never-ending walk. It was like from sun up to sundown, and it's like everything that I did, everything that I saw, everything I experienced, I looked at it in the spiritual eyes. So when I would go home at night, I would go to sleep. Of course, I would dream, and every time I would wake up from a dream, I would try to, you know, get some type of message from it. You know, that's how deep it was for me, and how joyful it was for me. And two particular dreams that I had. I had a dream about the Wizard of Oz, and I had a dream about the Vietnam War. And I probably saw it on television, you know, that night. And so the next day, I'm trying to figure out, okay, what does this mean? What does this mean?
I was going to say, those two don't seem like they go together.
How could it, right? And so the next night, I had the same dream. And it seemed like I had this dream like maybe three nights in a row. And I began to pray on it, you know, being spiritual. And this relationship that I had with Christ at the time, I believe that the Holy Spirit told me to start writing. So I started writing, and I wrote about 100 pages, you know, in about 2 or 3 days. And I never touched it again. I sat it down. I wasn't really a writer at the time. I was in school. And my goal in life was to understand the Bible. I wanted to understand all about the second coming of Christ. That's like my focus.
Right.
So here I am 20 years later, and everything that I have learned, that I have studied through mentoring and, courses, I wanted to share with everyone. But I didn't want to just write, what did God say? This is what he meant. I wanted to have fun. I wanted to have a good fiction story. So what I did, Edward, I went back and I dug up that old story, and I combined them both. And everything that I wrote about the Vietnam story and what I was trying to explain as far as my message about the second coming of Christ, I married the two. And when I added the time travel, it became a sci-fi.
Well, I have to tell you, it's a fascinating book. And for all of our listeners out there, Tony is an ordained Christian minister. I'll give you a little background. He's also a former U.S. Army Ranger. Now, the Rangers, that's pretty elite. That's Special Forces.
Yes, Special Operations, yes.
Wow.
I spent from 81 to 84 as it actually in the Ranger unit, and then from 85 to 90, I was a Ranger school instructor. So I actually trained other Rangers to become Rangers qualified.
Well, you're a pretty tough cookie then. So if I'm following you along, you watch The Wizard of Oz, and then you were thinking about your Vietnam War experience, and you wrote 100 pages, and then 20 years later, it all came to fruition?
Yeah, pretty much. Of course, I added quite a bit more. Basically, the story is when he's dreaming about time traveling, him and his squad actually time travel back with
They all go as one, as a unit?
As a unit, yes. So they become, in a sense, all observers of this Christian of Christ's first ministry.
Wow.
And they're there to witness everything Christ went through, the whole 3-year ministry from the baptism to the resurrection.
It's amazing. I like the way you mix in the time travel, because it's like, okay, I have these experiences and this is what's actually going on, but wouldn't it be so cool if we could go back and see what really was, the teaching? What was the answer, and instead of guessing? Was that something you were shooting for?
It's made up. It's fiction. But yes, I mean, the descriptions, that was some of the most fun I had writing the story, was actually writing about how Christ, or how I saw him raising people from the dead, how he was crucified, how he delivered certain sermons. And so what happens is, when the main character is in Vietnam,
right,
he's explaining a particular story to the squad that he's with, and that triggers their travel. And a lot of the times they're traveling right back to the event that the main character, Vincent, has just explained. But when he explains it, he explains it so that you can apply it to the second coming of Christ, which is what the story is about. And that's what my focus is. That's what my message is. First of all, I wrote the book because I wanted this message to get out there. It was very challenging because, a lot of people, a lot of readers don't want to really be taught anything unless you can sneak it in. They don't want to actually be taught something. And they definitely don't want to be preached to, and they don't like sermons. So I had to mix in my message without being philosophical, because my main character is a teacher, and I have my style of writing is pretty direct. So God is God, Jesus is Jesus, Paul is Paul. I don't have creations for them, and you have to guess who is who. So in that saying that, I had to be able to make it entertaining, persuasive, educating, without people really feeling like, okay, he's just preaching at me.
So in essence, it's like when you go to college and you have a professor teaching you, and you are so fascinated by the subject matter, you don't even realize that you just learned a lesson along the way.
Exactly.
Well, that's
but in a way, my character, he is teaching, but he's either having a conversation with someone, or he's actually teaching teaching the squad. So that's how I get it out. There's a lot of action involved. There's a lot of conversation involved, and they're in war, so they're in the middle of a battle too. So, and the squad, they're on a mission when this whole thing takes place.
It's just a fascinating concept, and congratulations on it. How's the response been so far?
I've had about 8 really good reviews on Amazon, so I'm happy with that. I'm happy that people are actually getting it, and I'm getting messages that say, I realize this is a Bible study book, but it's not boring. I didn't want to put it down. So I appreciate hearing opinions like that about my story.
Well, that's the highest compliment that any author can get. I couldn't put your book down.
I know. Who cares how many you sell? But if somebody really enjoys it, and I mean, that says it all. And see, what I've done is I've also created this story world where my main characters, in this instance, he's an immortal. So that's another part of the sci-fi. I have this story world where I've created, where I have these immortals here on Earth, and when they turn 21, they have these dreams. And these dreams include a dream about the ministry of Christ. So the main character is actually going through this dream. He doesn't know that he's actually been chosen as an immortal. He won't know until he comes out of the dream.
Uh-huh.
And then everything's revealed to him. So his goal in life, or his mission in life, is to gather all of God's elect and teach them and prepare them for the coming battle,
well,
preceding the second coming of Christ.
You know, Tony, I got to tell you, you're a pretty fascinating character there. Not like any minister that I've ever met, which is a compliment.
That could be a compliment, yeah. Thank you.
You know, there's a couple of things that our listeners don't know, and I was going to ask you about your background. And, you know, I've got to ask you about this ballroom dancing.
Yes. You know, I got
it. Is there anything that
accident.
You don't do, sir?
Yes. And, you know, it's funny because everything that I've done has helped me because I have these gigantic 8-foot mirrors in my dance studio.
Uh-huh.
And because I had a job cleaning windows 15 years ago, you know, I can take a squeezy and a sponge and whip, you know, right on through the right, cleaning them up, you know. So everything I've done has helped me. My whole me being self-employed, I was able to spend, you know, four to five hours a day, 7 days a week studying the Bible, and, you know, through different ministries and online studies and what have you. So everything that I asked God for, I asked God for two things. I asked for my own dance studio, and I asked for a deeper understanding of His complete plan. And so I got it. I mean, I got what I asked for.
Ask and you shall receive.
You know, and it's amazing because that's when you know that God truly does love you, when He's right there and your prayer is answered. You know, of course, those two prayers took years, but still, I'm set up exactly the way, and I feel as though, you know, I prayed for it, and it was His will, and I was obedient to it. So, and now I'm able to get this message out about. What I do, Edward, is I teach people how to take examples from the Bible. Uh-huh. Let's say, for example, Moses in the mountain, right? He's waiting for, the people at the bottom of the mountain are waiting for Moses to return. In that instance, he's like a Christ because he's returning with the instructions from God, and they're waiting for him. Well, they give up on him, of course, right? They waited too long. And so he returns, and he goes through this big thing with him. What I do is I show people how to take that example and overlay how the second coming of Christ will be almost exactly the same way. So I take all these examples in throughout the whole history of the Old Testament and the New Testament, and I show people how to do that. And it's very rewarding when people understand it. And so a lot of my book is about that. And I talk about these examples I talk about through the main character, and he talks about and teaches these examples to his troops.
All right, so you can read it and apply it to your own life as well.
And of course, yes. And then there's always that, you know, there's people who know exactly how to apply the Word of God to your own life, to your personal life, prosperity, Christian values, all of that. And my thing is, the bottom line is, you should also understand about the second coming of Christ. If you believe He's going to return, then you should understand about it.
Oh, okay. So, Tony, you have any upcoming events going on there? Anything that you want to let us know where you're going to be or what's coming up for you?
Let's see. Wednesday, August 31st, I'll be on Conversations Live with host Cyrus Webb, and he's on Blog Talk Radio.
Okay.
BlogTalkRadio.com, Conversations Live. And then September the 2nd and 3rd, I'm here in Atlanta at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution Decatur Book Fair in downtown Decatur, Georgia. And I have a booth. It's booth number 616.
Okay.
And they can go to DecaturBookFestival.com for more information on that. And then Tuesday the 20th from 7 to 9 p.m. here in Atlanta, again, is a television show called Atlanta Live. On WATC TV here in Atlanta. So, and yeah, the title of my next book is actually The Immortal Dancer.
Oh, I like it.
The Preparation. So,
you know, that's a really good title.
Thanks.
And you sound like you're going to be pretty dang busy there.
Yeah, busy is good. I'm looking forward to just getting exposed, and hopefully people will ask me questions about, you know, the concept, the theology, the doctrine my focus is on. And because there are people out there who really are looking and searching for something other than what they've heard. And And there are people out there like me who want all these examples explained. And I oftentimes use 1 Corinthians 10, verse 11, where it says everything was written as an example. Everything in the past and the history was written as an example, and it's a warning for everyone who's here in the end time. So I use that. If everything was written as an example, that means everything in the past in the Bible we're supposed to be able to use as an example and as a warning about the second coming of Christ or the end times. So if you're talking about the end times, of course, you're talking about the second coming of Christ. So, and that's what I do. That's my whole goal in life. That's what I look for when I pray, when I study. I'm looking for these examples so I can share with people.
Okay, sounds great. And you guys go out there and pick up a copy of A Dream Before Dying. Tony McCauley's out there. And be sure to catch him at the book fair and the book shows and on TV. And, of course, on our podcast, Get Behind Me, Not Stay There, available on iTunes and KSKQ 89.5 FM. Well, yeah, Tony, hey, it's been great, dude. And, you know, like I said, we'll get you up sometime in September as the featured author.
Okay.
And
thank you so much.
You know, hey, we'd love to have you back on again, you know, and when your new book comes out or even before. Whenever you feel the need, just let us know. We'll do another interview with you.
Okay, great.
To learn more about Tony McCauley, visit us at justimagineitinc.com.
Blackstone Audio, Inc. is proud to present a new work of fiction by one of Oregon's greatest authors, Chuck Palahniuk. The audiobook begins with a daughter of a narcissistic film star and a billionaire. Madison is abandoned at her Swiss boarding school over Christmas while her parents are off touting their new projects. She dies over the holiday of a marijuana overdose, and the next thing she knows, she's in hell. Madison shares her cell with a motley crew of young sinners that is almost too good to be true. A cheerleader, a jock, a nerd, and a punk rocker, united by fate to form the 6 feet under version of everyone's favorite detention movie, The Breakfast Club. Madison and her pals trek across the dandruff desert and climb the treacherous mountain of toenail clippings to confront Satan in his citadel. All the popcorn balls and wax lips that serve as a currency of hell won't buy them off.
About my own death, my death, I remember very little. My mom was launching a feature film, and my father had gained a controlling interest in something. Brazil, I think. So of course they'd brought home an adopted child from someplace awful. My brother de jure, his name was Goran. He of the brutish hooded eyes and beetling brow, an orphan sourced from some war-torn former socialist hamlet. Goran had been starved of the early physical contact and imprinting required for a human being to develop any sense of empathy. With his reptilian gaze and broad pitbull jaw, he arrived forever and always as damaged goods. But this only added to his appeal. Unlike any of my previous siblings, now apportioned to various boarding schools and long forgotten, I found myself quite smitten with Goran. For his part, Goran had merely to cast his churlish, ravenous eyes upon my parents' wealth and lifestyle, and he was determined to curry my acceptance. Add to those factors one overly large baggie of marijuana supplied by my dad, plus my impulse to finally smoke the nasty herb, if only to bond with Goran. And that's the sum total I'm able to recall about the circumstances of my fatal overdose. Currently, lying fully buried in a grave of fingernails, I listen to my heartbeat. I hear my breath rushing in my nostrils. Yes, without a doubt, it's hope that makes my heart continue to beat, my lungs to breathe. Old habits die hard. Above me, the ground heaves and shifts with every step of the tornado demon. The pairings trickle into my ears, stifling any sound of Babette's screams, stifling the clicking din from the sea of insects. I lie buried here, counting my heartbeats, resisting an urge to dig one hand sideways in search of Leonard's hand. In the next instant, my arms are pinned to my sides. The fingernails press in close, tightly around me, and I'm lifted into the stinking sulfurous air, rising into the flaming orange sky. The fingers of a huge hand are clasped around me as tight as a straitjacket. This giant hand has been thrust into the loose soil and has plucked me the way one might pull a carrot or radish from its buried slumber. Ye gods, I might be the privileged, wealthy, insulated scion of celebrity parents, but I still know where babies and carrots come from, although I was never entirely certain where Gorin originated. Soaring into the air, I can survey it all. The sea of insects, the great plains of broken glass, the great ocean of wasted sperm, an endless array of cages containing the damned. Below me spreads the whole geography of hell, including demons wandering hither and yon to gobble hapless victims. At the highest point of my ascent, a canyon of wet teeth await. A wind of rank, wet breath buffets me with a stink worse than the communal toilets at ecology camp. There heaves a monstrous tongue carpeted with taste buds the size of red mushrooms. All of this ringed by lips as fat as greased tractor tires. The hand brings me to the mouth, where my arms stretch to brace against the upper lip. My feet push against the lower lip, and like a fishbone, I hold myself too wide and rigid to be swallowed. Under my hands, the lips feel surprisingly plush, leathery like a banquet in a good restaurant, but very warm, like touching the upholstery of a jaguar someone's just driven from Paris to Rennes. So vast is the demon's face that all I can see is the mouth. In my peripheral vision, I'm vaguely aware of eyes above me, broad and glassy as department store windows, except curved outward, bulging. Those eyes, fenced by the black pickets of huge eyelashes. I'm conscious of a nose the size of a mud hut with two open doorways, each door hung with a curtain of fine nostril hairs. The hand pushes me against the teeth. The tongue thrusts to make wet contact with the button front of my cardigan sweater. In the moment, I am resigned to my immediate fate, to be masticated and swallowed, my bones cast aside like the skeleton of every Cornish game hen I've ever eaten. At that instant, the mouth screams. What occurs seems less like a scream than an air raid siren blasting point blank into my face. My hair, my cheeks, and clothing, these are all blown and rippling, snapping like a flag in a hurricane. One of my bass wegians slips from my foot, falling, tumbling, dropping to land on the ground beside a tiny figure sporting a bold blue mohawk. Even at this distance, I can see its archer standing beside the giant sizable bare foot. Having removed the oversized safety pin from his cheek, Archer is plunging the point, repeatedly removing it and plunging it, again and again into the tip of the demon's big toe. In the melee which ensues, I feel myself half-dropped, half-heaved, half-lowered until I land in the soft, scratchy fingernails. The same moment as my impact, hands grasp me, human hands, Leonard's hands, and pull me to shelter beneath the slurry of nail parings. But not before I see the same parachute hand which caught me now catch Archer and lift him, cursing, kicking his boots, slashing with his pin, to where the teeth snap shut, and in a single bite guillotine off his vivid blue head.
Chuck Palahniuk's best-selling novels include Tell All, Pygmy, Snuff, Rant, Haunted, Lullaby, Fight Club, Diary, Survivor, Invisible Monster, and Choke. He lives in the Pacific Northwest. For more information about top-selling titles from this award-winning company, go to www.blackstoneaudio.com.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're gonna like it. I think you're gonna feel you belong. A nocturnal vacation.
Get behind me now, Stay There is a Just Imagine It Inc. presentation and was recorded in the Blackstone Audio Inc. studios in Ashland, Oregon. If you would like more information about this show, or if you or someone you know would like to be featured, please call 541-708-0525 or visit justimagineinc.com. I'm Cyrus Emerson.
You wanna feel at home, 'cause you belong.
And I'm Lucia Sherman. We'll all be listening to Damned in preparation for our big Halloween show. So won't you join us? It will be scary.